Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Steadfast Group Limited 1H22 interim results call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number 1 on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Robert Kelly, Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer. Sir, please go ahead.
Thank you and good morning, everybody, and welcome to our half-year presentation. We'll start by, I refer you to page 5 of the deck we've got there, which is basically a bit of an operating update on how we've gone. And I guess up the top, we've completed EPS accretive acquisitions, including Coverforce, for the cost of $507 million, net of step-downs, and I'll refer to step-downs a little bit later in the presentation. But just reflecting on Coverforce, that was a major acquisition. Our model is to buy companies that are incredibly successful with great, strong management teams behind it. And I'd like to say that the cooperation of the management and the teams of Coverforce is exemplary, and the integration into the way we operate and the way they operate has been seamless. And Coverforce continues to deliver in accordance with the expectations that we have. So just the most interesting part of what we're doing now in these presentations is to give you a more definitive view of what our trapped capital project looks like. And if you see there, we completed 18 acquisitions representing 10.6 million EBITDA. And then to the right there on the presentation, you see there's a 30 further indicative valuations being provided representing an increase of another 16.4 million EBITDA. Then next line, we've got 5 term sheets and we're in due diligence has commenced for another 1.7 million EBITDA. And then to the right, you'll see we have a further 27 expressions of interest that are out in the market with our network. All of this trapped capital is for our network, our incumbent network, our existing people, the people that have been involved with us for sometimes 20 years, over 20 years. And then we've got a further 8 term sheets representing another 18.7 million out into the market. And then on the right side, you'll see there's 57 further discussions that require us to do. So the trapped capital project is a massive effective and accretive process that we've been going on to and have been highly regarded and accepted by the network generally. So then if you look at the analysis that our risk group and the product expansion there is putting into the market, it's quite astounding. We've now completed and are rolling out a comprehensive suite of enhanced risk management tools, solutions and systems for the broker network. They're absolutely built on a world basis that we can pick them up into any jurisdiction we want to do, and they're world class. Now, the risk group is an adjunct to what you might say the normal broking operations, and we've been able to create platforms that enable the broker to really lift their scale in the way they deal with their clients and also dial down risks accordingly. So when you get a hard market, as we've been through over the last few years, and now you've got a stable market where insurance is expensive to buy, then the analysis that a broker can actually do in terms of working with the risk transfer of their clients becomes really important in allowing a transfer of risk and an economic saving. So this analysis process that we've done has been, whilst world class, is very effective in some particular areas. That's led on to, of course, the establishment of some captives to take risk into specific areas and to allow the consumer of a captive product to share in the risk that they take, and also to mitigate the expansive area that they may be exposed to by risk transferring to the capital. And because of the nature of the market, we are rolling out mutuals, and these are designed to allow people who want to do incredibly good risk management, who have an eye to not wanting to make a claim and wanting to make sure that every dollar they spend or transfer to an insurer is adequately placed. So the risk group is extremely powerful. It's extremely cutting edge and being well received. And we continue, as you can see there, the enhancement of our products through the client trading platform. Well, and remember, the idea of that was to have enhanced policy wordings which represent best in class based on and developed as a result of the 17 years of looking at errors and omissions as we run our own program there, and also the triage team of our lawyers and our ex-brokers that look at circumstances that are not either covered under the policy or quantum reduced because of inadequacies in the policy. So that it's not just the ability to have a contestable platform, it's the ability to roll out a product that meets the expectations of the consumer at all times. I'd point out at that stage that we roll that out for the network. The entire network gets the benefit of all of those products. And in terms of international expansion, we've been involved with Unison and Steadfast now for a few years. We stepped up our position there to a majority position, and now we've started to work operationally with Unison and Steadfast in Hamburg. And we've been constrained a little bit by COVID over the last two and a bit years. So we now have two of our very senior executives working hand in hand with them. In fact, they've been there last week and this week. And we see this as an incredibly powerful expansion internationally for us. The ability to be able to work with 260 brokers over 130 countries all around the world who all do business currently with Unison Steadfast. So the opportunity to, shall I say, rather arrogantly, Steadfast, Unison Steadfast, is the next iteration of the development of this business internationally. Our London office, which we've had in hibernation over the last 2 years, reopens at the end of February. If any of you are around on the 27th of February, please come down to Lion Street and share a canap and a glass of wine with us. Oh, in April, I'm sorry, not 27th of April. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself there, so thank you. Nick Cook is correcting me on that. I'm glad to have people around me to protect me with this inadequacies. The other thing here, which is becoming more and more preeminent, is our interaction with our environment and our social governance. And we look at whether, when you become an ASX listed company, what your obligations are in terms of to your shareholders, in terms of society. And so we have a team working quite diligently. Certainly under the express wishes of the board, who see this as an important part of being a publicly listed company, is to participate in the environment in a correct way, to work to how we can make ourselves carbon neutral. It's a difficult process because it's not a particularly friendly way that people think about this, but we're taking this on with great gusto, and our ESG strategy, once we get it finite and start building towards that carbon neutral position, we'll then be able to roll out to the network. So to enable the 2,000 odd offices that we've got to actually benefit from the work we're doing on ESG, and to, in their local environment, actually put our footprint towards what a carbon neutral would look like for them across a broad church of people of actors. So, We did in this country, in this company, probably not do enough for the First Nation people, our Aboriginal people, and I talk to you here on land owned by the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, for which we're very grateful that our forebears in this country allowed us to have access to this. And so our reconciliation action plan is something that we just got renewed with great effort. I must say it took a long time to renew it, so it's treated with great dignity by this company and also by getting it through. So we believe it's important that from the social environment, from the environmental environment, that we actually make sure that we're at the forefront of doing that. And then the last on page five is the claim solutions. We started this last year, and we're now rolling out Steadfast Claim Solutions for our underwriting agencies in cohort with our insurance partners who candidly have come to us and said, it's interesting to see that we delegate authority for you to underwrite business, and then we give the claim settling authority to somebody who doesn't know anything about it, just looks at it in isolation. This system is working really finitely to make sure that the connection between the client, the insurer, and the underwriting agency is absolutely quick, and the delivery of a claim is expeditious. So that's basically our operating structure. So I'll turn you over to page six now and talk to you about our broking network. And candidly, it's a very good story. It's an easy story for somebody to me that heads up this business to talk to you about. You get 15.6% growth, and if you go to the bar chart at the bottom of page six, and you have a look at the exponential growth that we're doing across the bottom, it's a wonderful story. And the story, quite simply, is this: that the intermediated business in Australia, the Steadfast Network, does 36.55% of the intermediated business. It's a wonderful percentage to own, but it's a huge responsibility to have to make sure that everything we do on such a large sector of the intermediated business is representative of best in class and what they should be. But organic growth was up 8.3%, and we got price increases across all lines. So, again, 87% of our business is in commercial lines, and interestingly, now 13% of our business is in retail. So if you go back to 1999, when we did our first data warehouse, it was 4%. So at a time when people would expect that intermediated house car would fade away from us, we're actually growing each year tremendously powerful. So on the right side, it's a pretty good story. 8.3% organic growth. Interestingly, 3.5% out of our AR network. We highlight that to show you how that's continually growing. And then 3.8% coming from new brokers. So total growth from there. The network's 361 brokers in Australia, 54 in New Zealand, and 19 in Singapore. And our investment activity in the first half was 19 new equity holdings, including bolt-ons, and 10 step-downs in equity holdings and 5 step-ups in equity holdings. So the 11 odd people in our M&A team, they certainly are never looking for something to do and are very active and working through it. The client trading platform, okay, it's on track to do $1 billion in GWP this year. It's up 31% from last year. It's heading towards, it's doing a rolling 12 of $903 million at the moment, which is up 29%, and trending towards the full year at $1 billion. And if people say to you, are you only doing $1 billion on the client trading platform, I'd ask you to reflect on how many other systems around the world are delivering a contestable platform in 18 to 25 seconds for the consumer. So $1 billion is outstanding. Our equity brokers contribute $123.8 million, or up 16% in our EBITDA. So the network, I reaffirm, Steadfast runs a network for everybody. Everything we do is absolutely the same, whether they're a small broker in Wangaratta we have no equity in, or a major player in Queensland who are doing a couple of $100 million worth of turnover. Everybody gets the same deal. Okay, we benefit from our equity participation and for the dividend flow that comes from that. So go to page seven now. The underwriting agencies, we've worked on this I personally did my first underwriting agency in 1985. So I've seen this in my career as being a way forward to grow business and to deliver better service to the consumer by operating with niche businesses. So the underwriting agency's up 16.3% to $852 million. Now, if you reflect on the bottom of page 7 to the bar chart there, and you look at FY20, FY20 was $115 million above FY19. If you look at FY21, we were $60 million above the prior year. So you started to get levelling out, and you start to say, well, that's okay. We had the original jump from the then hard market, so it's going to level out and probably go back to a flat line. And then all of a sudden, you look at the first half of 22 when we're up $119 million. Now, that's because of expertise. It's because of diligence in the delivery of the product and solving the brokers and their clients' problems in a difficult time when markets are constrained and pricing is in flux all the time. So just in terms of that uplift, it's price and volume. We're getting price across, but we're also getting volume. And just reflecting on what volume does in an underwriting agency, quite often you will double or put up 25% more or 30% in sales, but you do not have the same increase in your expenses. Your expense line stays in roughly in accordance with the inflationary effect you would expect for the base. It doesn't go up in exponential proportions to the sales that you do. So 16.9%, 14.5% organic. As you can see there, only 1.8% from acquisitions, very small amount in acquisitions. So that means that the 27 agencies that we've got and the over 100 niche products are very well supported by the broking community. Remember, all our agencies are available to the entire market. We don't have anything restricted to Steadfast. I'm a believer that competition stimulates the best in class of anything that you deliver for the consumer. So if we can have it out in the entire market, it keeps everybody sharp. And I think our excellent performance is due to our long-term strategy of making sure that we provide the capital providers that allow us to deploy their capital into the market with a return. And so it's interesting, I've just come back from London. I spent part of the last week and the week before in London. It was an amazing journey this time because every one of our capital providers wanted to offer us more capital to deploy into the Australian and New Zealand market. It's testament really to the work that we've done on our underwriting agencies. I mean, these are not fresh businesses. These are mature businesses diligently worked upon and producing results that benefit the consumer, that are expeditious for the broker, and make sure that we are able to go to London and know that we've produced a profit for them. So I guess that's about all I can say on the underwriting agencies. If you go to page 8, this is something that everybody asks us about, so we spent time on this, our tech division. And I think the client trading platform is been outstanding in the way that it's starting to gain each month and gain impetus with the brokers. We continue to work on our auto rating capabilities. We discovered really back in the day, over probably several years ago, that if you don't auto-rate product lines, you don't get anywhere with them. So we build every month we're working on auto-rating. Everything we do, we're working on auto-rating. So we continue to run out those. A great example of that was the motor fleet, which we've now got the major support from the major players in auto rating that, and that's great, gaining every month with more and more turnover. So just, we have 9 business lines. We've got 16 insurers over that. I was asked yesterday, are we expanding that? Yes, we're always looking and willing to expand those insurers, providing that they add value into what we want to do for the consumer, and also to infill those lines with more and more insurers. But I mean, the next bullet point there is, We have 19,201 active users on the client trading platform, of which 8,300 access the client trading platform through our Insight system, our own back office system. And pleasingly, just under 10,000 users access it through Winbee, and just over 1,126 access it through other broking systems. By any means, by any rule, by any look, that is an outstanding position to have on an automated platform that we own. So we get strong client outcomes on the client trading platform. The consumer is well served. It's contestable. The commission rates do not vary. They are fixed. So you do a dollar's worth of business, you get the same commission if you do $100 million worth of business going through. And it really locks together the three partners in an insurance transaction: the consumer, the broker, and the insurer. It's the best in class product, it's contestable, and there's no remuneration given for more turnover being put through. So everything's aligned. We now have 167 brokers live, and bear in mind we merged quite a few brokers, so as we merge brokers, they go back to being one system. And we have an additional 27 committed and in our migration program, and 76 others that candidly, to be frank, when we get through the order book we've got now, that we'll get to from there. So it's pretty simple when you look down the right-hand side. Up 29.2%. Currently a rolling 12 of 903, target of a billion, and at the bottom you can see in the bar charts the growth up 110 million from last year. So these are big jumps in terms of what it should look like. So greatly successful, and I guess probably the most important part is that our interim dividend is up 18.2%, and that really reflects something that, as a board and as a company, we believe we have to do. We have to look after our shareholders, we have to look after our employees, and we have to look after the consumer. Stephen, what was the percentage of our NPATA that we put into that?
Yeah, so we typically do. We have a policy range of 65 to 85% of profits that we pay out as dividends. Profit there is net profit after tax. So in the last few years, it's really been very close to 75%. I think there's been absolutely conjecture whether it's paid on NPAT or NPATA. It's always been on NPAT, and hence why you're seeing the dividend uplift here is pretty much matching, I guess, the earnings uplift, earnings per share, to keep a very similar payout of about 75% of our NPAT.
Yeah, and I mean that's what we've told the market, and it's our board directive. And I mean we're absolutely emphatic that we work to that all the time. So the bar chart shows what we want to do: accretive growth, share the profit, keep it going forward, do better. So from the sub 3 cents first half in 14, we're at 5.2 cents in first half 22. So I'll just refer you to page 10, and we've upgraded our guidance. You can see there the underlying EBITA is from 330 to 340 million, and the NPAT is from 163 to 170 million, and our underlying diluted EPS is from 12.5% to 17.5%. There's a few key assumptions there. They're basically that the market continues really in its moderate premium rate increases. Our total acquisition EBITDA targets are met. We're pretty confident on those, and we detailed those out to you a little bit earlier. And I think that the technology spend stays, and that there's no negative consequences of COVID. Hopefully that Omicron's starting to level out. We're going to bring people back into our office on the 1st of March. And having just spent 10 days in London, I can tell you the way that that city and country is treating COVID at the moment is not much different to the flu. You can go around, and whether that's right or wrong, that system and that city is back in online, and I guess in some ways we've got to get Australia back online. So we support it. I'll just refer to you on the waterfall chart there, the acquisitions and the step downs. So every time we do a deal to bring in somebody in one of the businesses that we think are high performers and want to buy into the business, we lose a bit of that EBITDA. So I think in FY23 we could lose somewhere between 2 and 5 million EBITDA. So that means in organic growth we have to get back to the status quo and then grow over the top. So I just point that out to you there. That so you've got eight in acquisitions, 2% in step down, so you get the 6% uplift from there. So I think that's our guidance. I won't talk any further. I'll hand over to Stephen Humphries, our CFO, to run through the financial summary. So thank you, everybody, and I'll come back to you when it's question time. Yeah, Stephen.
Thanks, Rob. Just perhaps a couple more points on that guidance as a prelude to going through the first half. Our organic growth expectations have now been lifted on the basis of a good solid first half. So the upgrading guidance for 2.5% points on the EPS is really driven from that organic growth story. The acquisitions, we're expecting to meet the original target of 6%. It just happens to be that whilst we think we'll actually buy more businesses this year, that will give us 8% growth because of those step downs in equity holdings. The net of all that will still be the 6%. Target we had originally. So the step downs, it's generally speaking from we had, for instance, a high majority stake, let's say it's 80%, you might then sell down some to the management and now own 70%. So you'll still see all the EBITDA coming through because as a subsidiary you always record the 100% figure, but you'll see a lot more of the non-controlling interest coming out in terms of how the bottom line gets constructed for the NPAT. Moving on, just now, as I say, into the actual first half and reviewing that, the actual slide 12 there, you'll see the reconciliation of our stat profit to underlying numbers. And probably the first thing to say is that we had a very significant uplift in our investment in Johns Lyng. As you would have noted, the share price for that has gone up. We also did do a follow-on investment in their capital raise to a pro rata to our equity stake, and of course have enjoyed the uplift on that as well. So we've actually removed $18.2 million after tax profit from our actual Johns Lyng investment to derive our underlying numbers underneath. So not a bad thing to remove from numbers to get the underlying. We've also have bought as part of Trapped Capital some interest in associates, which then become subsidiaries. We have to step up the original valuation of that associate stake, and so we remove that profit out of our stat accounts as a non-recurring item. And we've also removed an impairment we had in one of our agencies that was struggling with COVID, just to make sure that it was fairly valued in the books. As you'll see from our overall agency portfolio, the agency as a whole has been going swimmingly well. So in essence, we actually take $104.9 million of statutory profit and we dial it down to the $76.3 million that we use for underlying earnings, which is a 26% uplift against the corresponding half last year. Let's go to the headline numbers on slide 13. We've laid down quite significant uplift in earnings over 1H21 with very solid double-digit increases on every bottom line metric. The revenue was up again, of course, thanks to the continuing hard insurance market, but also from acquisitions. And despite the cost pressures that were foreshadowed some time back, the margins were maintained and improved. So our cost increases were more than offset by the revenue growth, leading to those very solid uplifts, as you see there. So the 19% up on the revenue, EBITDA up 22.7%, net profit after tax up 26.3%. Some of that acquisitions was funded, as we know, from the capital raise, so the earnings per share dialed down from the 26% to the 20.6%. Cash earnings up 25.3% and cash EPS up 19.6%. So we experienced an uptick in volumes and prices, with prices rising, you know, in that 5-7% mark that we anticipated, with a couple of percent volume increase on top of that. There was a little bit of return of discretionary spend, but there's probably more expected in the second half when we presumably not normalise to a more realistic level, again, assuming lockdowns have all but finished. The acquisition growth was obviously headlined by the Coverforth acquisition in August 21. Very strong deal flow from the trapped capital. And as we mentioned, we've recently sold down some equity in our consolidated businesses to senior management. If you exclude the Coverforth acquisition, our multiples for buying insurance intermediaries was anywhere between 8 and 10 times, and averaged around about 9 times when you put it all together. The seasonality of earnings, as you can tell with our forecast for the year, it's round about 46% first half, 54% second half, a little bit more biased towards the second half this year, as those acquisitions that we've done obviously have a bigger impact on the second half than the first half, and obviously some of those acquisitions that we've have made will now have an impact into FY23. There's already a couple of $1 million worth of bottom line profits that we have booked into for next year from the acquisitions that we've done. We now go to slide number 14. This shows you, as we typically do, the dissection of our EBITDA growth into our key components. So our organic growth there was a very solid 10.5%, which is above our original guidance range, hence the uplift in the guidance. The technology headwinds was a smaller 0.4%. We do expect a little bit more spend in the second half, mainly as we find staff and actually get them employed. It has been a little bit delayed, some of that spend, so we expect it a little bit further in the second half. And the acquisition growth there of 12.6%. Now, of course, as I said, a lot of that was funded through the equity raise, hence why the NPAT is more of that 6% growth coming through the bottom line. So all those components are ahead of our expectations. Upgrading guidance. There's a couple of areas I want to note. There's a couple of areas I'm going to be cautious on for the second half. As I said, we expect some return of the discretionary spend going into the second half. For example, our convention is all systems go at the moment for March. There'll be some spend to do there. Technology spend we've talked about. The sale of those equity interests to management would come through. And we've had a very strong agency growth, which you've seen or about to dial into. We're going to expect just a slightly more muted growth rate. It's still a strong growth rate, but not as high as the first half, which was obviously a very splendid result. We just want to be a little bit careful. We'd rather see it before we pronounce it. Let's assume a slightly dialed down agency growth rate in the second half. The amount that we capitalised on our balance sheet was a touch higher than prior years, but a large portion of that was with some of our subsidiaries actually investing into technology, as we talked about with the robotics and automation, et cetera. We go down to the broking results. So slide 15. This is, again, where we, just reminding, this is where we show the 100% results as if we owned 100% of businesses, which we don't, and we take away things like profit shares to show that period-on-period performance. We are, of course, own 100% of the network, but we own roughly 64% of the pure broking businesses, so roughly three-quarters of this earnings you see on this page comes through to the listed entities. So for the year, there was just over 8% organic growth in the revenue, which is fair, roughly that 8% growth in GWP. We get about 70% of that flowing through coming into our numbers, so about 5.6%, and then you dial up with the volume growth, getting us back to that 8% organic growth. We did foreshadow, so those additional costs coming back into the business. Remember, on 1 July 20 was all but a wage freeze with the middle of COVID and what could it be. Come 1 July 21, we did basically 2 years of wage increases coming through. There was also a little bit of JobKeeper last year. And this year, you know, for instance, people like Rothbury had their biennial conference. So if you took all that out, we could have shown, instead of 3.9% growth, we could have actually shown actually even 5%. My aim was to try to make sure that we mitigated the cost increases with the premium increases. We actually achieved that and some extra. Obviously, we had the significant acquisitions in the first half. You can see there where we've added 12.1% to the bottom line as a result of those acquisitions. This year, so far, with that spend of over $500 million, it looks like this will be our largest year, including our original float year of acquisitions, particularly when you look at the pipeline that Rob's referred to earlier in the slide deck. So some of those acquisitions will flow through next year, but that's the impact on the first half here. In fact, a lot of those businesses were purchased in November and December, and then we actually gave our mergers and acquisitions team a break in January.
I think that's important to say. We take the team out of action, didn't we, for January, because they've been working night and day.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, but however, they're all back and they were anxious to get back. Well, I don't know whether they're anxious is the correct word, but they all came back to work in the beginning of February.
So moving to slide 16, on the agency side, we own roughly 94% of what you see on the page here and management owning the other 6%. For the fourth year in a row, this is performance that's ahead of our own expectations. Really solid performance across most of the businesses. The hardening market continues to provide great opportunities to quote. So we've had further market share gains again, subject only in a few instances to some capacity constraints, but overall very, very solid result, both price and volume movements across the different agencies. So significant top line organic revenue growth of 15.8% that you see here. There were some cost increases that we processed, like with brokers, with the wages, et cetera, but there was margin expansion with businesses as you see there, bottom line organic earnings growth of 20.4%. Slide 17, our businesses, as I always say, convert their profits into cash very quickly. So we've had over 100% of our $93.6 million of NPAT converted into cash, which does reflect the typical seasonality where you have high sales, particularly May and then June in particular, that converts into cash in July, August. Our debtor days continue to be equal or better than our historical levels, and even our premium fund collections again have also continued without concern with arrears rate far superior to the pre-COVID levels. That's a great litmus test for us about how SME business is going in Australia. So we're very confident on the cash flows continuing through. The $106 million cash flow there, you'll see if you take out the dividend that we pay, the final dividend, there's still just short of $50 million of free cash flow. And we've obviously invested that into our ongoing acquisition activities. On our balance sheet on slide 18, besides our acquisition activity, which we financed, as we talked about, mainly through the new capital, we've actually also reset our debt facilities. So we've increased our debt facilities up to $660 million, which matches, if you like, the new equity position that we have. So if we were happened to borrow all of this $660 million, we would roughly get to that 30% gearing, maximum gearing that the board has mandated. The gearing at the moment as of 31 December is just short of that, short of 20%, so 19.7%. We also do have an accordion facility baked into our new debt facility, so if we need to access further debt, it is there. It's a no-cost facility that is ready for us. And as you can see, the facilities extend now all the way out to November 26. So as of today, we actually have $315 million of undrawn facilities that we can access for corporate purposes. That's partly in thanks to the $15 million of oversubscriptions that we took on the retail share purchase plan. And whilst that does dilute our earnings per share growth about 1%, we thought that was the most appropriate given our pipeline of acquisitions and the right thing to do for our retail shareholders.
I think we should. That's a very important point, isn't it, Steve? And the board's very cognizant that we should look after the retail shareholders.
Yeah.
And indeed, we think about that all the time.
So given the ratio's circa 20%, we would expect the next raft of acquisition opportunities to be funded via the debt facility and our free cash flow, of course. Another hot point I just wanted to raise there, given this is a look like a rising interest rate environment, just to let you know that we actually have more money on deposit, as you can see on our balance sheet there, $653 million for our subsidiaries, let alone the amounts on deposit for our associates, compared to the amount that we actually borrow, which is in that 300 range. So if interest rates rise, we actually think we're a benefactor on that on our P&L. And I'd also note we've actually hedged some interest rates on our debt facility, around about $200 million of them. So should interest rates rise significantly, we actually won't see proportionate rise in our interest rate costs on our debt facilities, but we would expect to see an uplift on our earnings. So we actually think we're positively attuned to a rising interest rate environment on our P&L.
It's a natural hedge.
Yeah. So I think that's probably a key summary. Hand it back to Rob.
Okay. I think we're going to questions now, aren't we?
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you are on speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Andrew Buncombe with Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my questions. The first two that I have are in relation to the guidance. Can you just give us some colour? How much of the guidance reflects contributions from future acquisitions, or anything in the next 4 or 5 months would be all upside? Thanks.
Yeah, we have a small amount of acquisition growth coming into the next 6 months into our forecast that allows to fill up that 6% bucket, but it's certainly not all of the acquisition opportunities that Rob has highlighted on page 5. So should some of those land into this year, then we'd have to consider how that acquisition bucket performs, or given where we are, depending on the time of the year, how much of that flows into FY23. But there's a small portion, because we're obviously confident of executing on them, but we're also not that aggressive to say that every deal will cross the line or come through before 30 June. Sometimes they take a while to come through.
But Andrew, if something does come through like that, then certainly as a board, we're very cognizant that we keep the market fully informed on that.
Excellent. Second question is again on the guidance. Can you just give us some colour around what premium rate rises you're assuming behind those numbers? Thanks.
Yeah, we're assuming that 5-7% to continue through, which is in line with what we saw. We're not seeing at this stage any softness on those numbers. If anything, the momentum continues to be stronger. So we're very confident on the 5-7% in this market should continue.
Maybe a side question on that one. A number of the major insurers have been calling out 9-10%. Some of your competitors have been calling out sort of the 7-9% range. Why do you think for your book mix it's a few hundred basis points lower than that? Thanks.
I think the insurers are optimistic, and I think they always want to make you, people like you, feel comfortable by saying that they're going to drive rate.
Maybe customers would have a different view. And then the final one for me.
That's why you've got to have an insurance broker, Andrew. You've got to make sure that they're sifting through the market for you and making sure that you're not burning your dollars for things. So I agree. Thank you.
And then just the final one from me. as more products and insurers continue to plug into the SCTP, when should we expect the annual investment in the technology to peak? Thanks.
That's a difficult question to say, because as more product lines come on and as more opportunities come on, and, you know, I've had some discussions in London about some propositions that might come out there, then you have to keep investing to do that, and then your return comes in, you know, an 18-month time after that. So I don't think you should look at the client trading platform as an end game. I think it's always something that when opportunities present, you've got the base platform there that you're going to continue to invest in it. And also at the moment, we're having a complete rejig of that platform. There's nothing wrong with the platform per se, but if you think about the genesis of that, this occurred in probably 12 years ago, 13 years ago, then the ability to move data has changed dramatically over that last 13 years. If you were to build the client trading platform today, you wouldn't build it on the same basis that we built it in the past. So we're unpicking, it's not the sins of the past, but what the status quo that existed 13 years ago does not represent the status quo today. So you have to continue to invest in it. Okay.
That's it from me. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Kieran Chirji with Jarden. Please go ahead.
Morning, Rob. Stephen, a couple of questions. Maybe just starting on the number of brokers sort of through the network. It does look like there was quite a large number of mergers through last half, I think, you know, close to 30. So just interested on sort of what's going on there, what's driving that, and potential implications down the track. I mean, if those non-equity brokers are extracting more efficiency, what implications that has as to sort of, I guess, acquisition costs going forward?
Well, let me say that acquisition costs are not going backwards, okay? And candidly, I would hate to be Robert Kelly circa 2022, considering whether he'd like to go into and convert a network into a listed company and then go and try and raise capital and say, you know what, we're going to have to pay between 10 and 12 times EBITDA. It was hard enough to convince the investment income that paying 7.5 times EBITDA back in 2012 and then floating in 13. So it isn't going backwards. We are fortunate that we have had a successful company, and we're producing really good results and good profits for our investors. So we're in a much different position today as we head towards the end of financial year 22 to be able to pay more than what we paid for in those early days. The game started. And I just reflect on, you know, sort of how much a Porsche cost in 2013, okay? And you could get a really good Porsche for about 180 grand. Now, if you want the same car, it's $380,000. So if you want to buy a quality car, you have to pay a lot more for it today than what you would have had to pay for in 2013. Conversely, if you want to get quality businesses, you have to pay top dollar for them now. And remember, our modus operandi has always been to buy quality businesses, pay full value for them, and get earnings per share growth straight away.
Okay, and the drivers of that sort of merger activity in that non-equity channel. I mean, can you just give us a little bit of colour around what's occurring?
Well, I think it falls into a couple of areas really: age, and the ability not to have succession can be one of the factors that somebody goes, well, hang on. Is it time to take? And I guess a testament to that is really our trap capital project, where we simply said to people, is it time to release some of the capital that you've built up in this business? So I think, and if you'd have run trap capital 5 or 6 years ago, it wouldn't have been as successful as it is today. And candidly, people are working longer now. You know, the people are not retiring at the traditional retirement age now. That seems to have gone out the window completely. But some people are going, you know what, if I am going to work on past my 65th birthday, maybe it's a good idea to take some of the capital out of this business and use it and still keep building the business. So I think age, succession, the difficulty of compliance, okay, let somebody else have the responsibility for that. The intricacies of legislation, of how it's changing, there's a lot of... Now, if you become part of an equity broker, then a lot of that responsibility is completely taken away from you, because we roll out all of these factors and give you the ability to have a mothership to come to talk to, to develop internally how you want to resolve these things. So I think that's a few factors. And also, I think if you go back two decades ago, you could buy insurance brokers for between 1.25 and 1.5 times commission and fee income. Okay, the viability of an insurance broking business and of course an underwriting agency business or MGA has shown sustainability over a long period of time, and a bit like in some ways rent rolls in real estate agencies. People are going, you know what, these are annuity businesses almost. They're really good to get in. The cash flow is reliable, so that's made them desirable, and once you get supply and demand in a desirable sector, then you're going to get cost push inflation by prices going up, just by people seeing more value than on buying these businesses than somebody else does.
And just to add to that, don't forget, as you said, part of Trapped Capital is we have some of the acquisitions we've done directly, but some we've also done through our existing businesses.
Yes.
So we put, you know, one or two businesses together with other ones, and we've also hubbed a couple of our brokers together as well. So some of that, a subset of that number, is what we have ourselves done in terms of putting businesses together.
Yeah, I like, for instance, I'll give you, I'm in negotiation with somebody at the moment as part of Trapped Capital, and the reality is it's a sensationally good business. The guy's in his 60s, but doesn't want to stop working, but is sick to death of running his back office, and you know, he's got a staff of 25. He's sick to death of his HR. So what he'd like to do would be to sell a great proportion of the business, take his capital out of that business, and then continue to work without the encumbrances of HR, computers, back office, and audit, and we take all that away seamlessly. So it's a different paradigm to what it was.
Okay, and just quickly on the timing around the deals you completed in the half just gone, I think at the AGM, from memory, you said about 4 mil of completed EBITDA, and now it's sort of closer to 11. So presumably that was done very late in the half, so we've still got half a year contribution of that to come into the 23 year. Is that the way to think about it?
Yeah, that's right. So I think we closed about 5 or 6 deals in November and about the same number in December. So, yes, we worked, as I said, the M&A team worked extremely hard to get all those deals away.
We also increased the M&A team a bit, and we have a really good program for bringing graduates through Steadfast. You know, we've roughly got about 12 or 13 graduates working in this business that we've brought in over the last few years, and some talent out of that graduate program went into our M&A division, and candidly, their expertise, their aggression, their skill has helped dramatically in that area.
Yeah, it has. And normally we'd say we do, on average, about one transaction a fortnight. If you look at the numbers we put forward for this half year, we've actually done more than one transaction a week. It's been a very, very busy half year.
And maybe just a final question on CoverForce, Rob. I think you mentioned in your opening remarks it's travelling well. I just wanted to check a couple of numbers, because at the FY21 result, I think sort of the implied metrics and value you've paid for the business suggested you're expecting around 33 mil of I think it was actually EBITDA, so a little bit inconsistent with the 10 mil EBITA contribution you show in your stat accounts for Coverforce coming through in first half 22. So it seems to be tracking a little bit behind that FY21.
Yeah,
you got into 22. Is that just pure seasonality around sort of obviously a stronger April renewal or June quarter renewal?
There is some seasonality, but I was also going to say that the accounting for Coverforce is quite intricate. Some of it flows through to the associate line, some of it flows through all the overall revenue and expenses, etc. So I think the best thing to summarise it, to put aside all the accounting anomalies, is to say that it's absolutely tracking in accordance with the EBITDA that we bought and that we had pronounced on the day one. It is tracking absolutely to that budget.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Kira.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Siddharth Parameswaran with JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. A couple of questions, if I can. First one, just on the operating leverage that was evident in the underwriting agency business and which didn't seem to come through in the broking business. The EBITDA grew quicker than the revenues in the agencies, but it went the other way in the broking business. I was just wondering if you could just provide some color on exactly why that was. I mean, I think Stephen, you mentioned that both businesses had a step up in expenses, salaries, and lack of JobKeeper. But is there anything else we should think about in terms of profit commission or anything else which might have boosted those numbers? And is that uplift sustainable?
Sure. So the actual numbers we present there are, we strip our profit shares because that can come and go. So we it's got nothing to do with profit shares. What it relates to is, in particular, is that the volume growth in our agencies was superior to our brokers. Now, our brokers actually performed actually better than what I was expecting, but the agencies performed way better than I expected. So that volume growth for the agencies, generally speaking, gets absorbed by the existing cost base. So you're not necessarily hiring a lot more staff. We've obviously spent a bit of time also on automating processes there to be able to absorb that extra new business into the system. So generally speaking, both of them had to, cope with the wage rises, but the actual volume was able to be leveraged through the agencies quite nicely. I repeat that for 4 years, they've actually outperformed our expectations every single half year, but I'm still not prepared to say that they'll outperform my expectation in the second half. I'd rather see it and then report it to see if that comes through in the second half.
Yeah, if you go back to what I said 3 years ago, I said, look, we've had a stellar first half, but candidly, I don't know how long this can continue. And I was wrong.
Okay. It's continued.
So we have to really be conservative about being convinced it's going to continue. You know, in other words, we keep going to another summit every time and getting there. Where Stephen and I are always conservative about whether we're on the platform. Yeah. By the way, Sid, you sound really, really sprightly and on a digital daughter sleep all night last night, did she?
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, she's in a different room to me, Rob, so I got good sleep. Thank you.
Good.
I had a second question on the growth that we're actually getting. I was hoping you could just provide us comfort on, or maybe some colour actually around where the growth is in the underwriting agencies. So which underwriting agencies are actually providing this growth? And the related question around that is just around strata and whether there's any risks at all from some of the potential reviews into that market.
Yep. Look, it's a good question, Sid. But let me tell you that the two of the 27 agencies didn't do well, but 25 of the underwriting agencies absolutely shot out the lights. You know, like Doors, for instance, are just taking that, which is a specialist collector car and prestige car underwriting agencies. Okay, when we bought that, it was doing $12 million GWP. It did over $41 million last year. It's an outstanding business. Miramar topped out over $100 million. Now, these are well-established businesses, established with the brokers, servicing the area. So they're growing and growing. So across the range, as I say, sports underwriting suffered greatly from COVID, okay? And QUS, which is the smaller underwriting agency for Strata, AIG, who was the capacity provider behind that, didn't want to continue writing that sort of business. Now, over 70% of that business is what considered retail strata business, and it's not easy to get it placed. So we're struggling to get the capacity provided in that. So they're the two lowlights in our underwriting agency, but as you can see, they were not impactful on the overall result of the underwriting agency. To your point on strata, it's crucially important that we have a big responsibility there, because we have some of the best strata brokers in Australia, and we certainly have two of the best underwriting agencies with Axis and with CHU, well-established, long capacity providers and market leaders in the sectors that they've got. So, yes, we're cognizant that the REM structure in underwriting agencies possibly could come under review. In fact, we have commissioned John Trowbridge to do an independent review of remuneration in the strata industry and the impact on the consumer and the way the players, and there are a few players in it. You've got the managing agents, you've got the brokers, and you've got the consumer, the strata itself, how they interact, what services they provide, and how they get remunerated. So I'm hopeful that review will be completed certainly over the next 5 or 6 weeks. And when it is, it'll be a public domain information that we put out. So I think we've assumed some responsibility in that area in cohort with the managing agents and brokers, both within Steadfast and without Steadfast, and a range of strata managers to have a look at that whole section. And I guess that's probably self-regulation at the utmost point. So we'll keep you informed on that.
Okay, so just to be clear, you're not expecting any meaningful change in terms of impact on your business?
No, but I'm also cognizant that this area is an ever-increasing area. You know, stratas are going up everywhere, you know, multiple buildings, and sometimes there's erroneous information given out about the pricing mechanisms, and erroneous information is given out about how it's treated in various jurisdictions. And our reinsurance divisions work strongly with the people in far north Queensland to bring some sense and sensibility up there. And indeed, the impact of certain parts of Australia, more particularly the eastern coast, and in sometimes highlighted in far north Queensland, the impact of climate change in terms of weather events is making it very difficult to actually make profits in some areas. So I don't think why we're doing this review of the remuneration is to actually be ahead of the game, and to make sure that if we're ever come under review, that we've canvassed the position with all the players in it, and we have hopefully we will have an agreed point of view that would be sustainable in the market, and that if looked at by anybody would say that is a very fallible way to go about doing your business.
Okay, thank you. Just a very very quick question. It's just about the outlook for M&A from here. I mean, you mentioned that FY22 is obviously a very strong year. I think it's likely to be the best year that you've had in terms of the amount spent. But just from here, I mean, should we view this as an outlier, or is this, you know, effort to get more and more deals done likely to continue, and, you know, perhaps more expansion overseas? So I think you could just comment on how you're looking at FY22 versus the outlook from here.
Look, with what we've got on our plate and the rest of our network, there's still over $120 million worth of EBITDA in the rest of our network.
Yeah, we've probably approaching, but not yet, 40% of the network that we might have an equity stake in.
Yeah.
Still 60% that we don't.
Still 60%. So, So in our own backyard, we've still got a huge amount of potential to go forward with. Now, in saying that, have we reached saturation point in the Australian market? No, not at all. We haven't. But if you remember, we took equity, you know, we've been in London. We've had a London operation for several years on the ground. If you think about, we took the equity, the minor equity position in Unison, and it formed its name, Unison Steadfast, and then we uplifted it to 60%. And now we are not just an investor in that business, but we are operationally involved in working with that business and not restructuring it so much as redirecting it in terms of what it does for its, I mean, it's heading towards a $40 billion GWP that goes through Unison Steadfast.
US.
So, US. So if you think about that and you think about our involvement over several years with them and you think about the lack of work we've done with them due to COVID, this is an exciting time for us. You know, two of our most senior people here have been there for 2 weeks working. So now we're redirecting the efforts of the CEO to actually be out on the ground doing what made him successful in building this business in the first place, and then now we're helping them on their marketing, we're helping them on their back office, we're helping them on their risk services. So we are doing business with 260 brokers all around the world. Now we've got our skill to convert that platform of brokers into a whole lot of things that Steadfast has achieved in Australia and New Zealand and Asia. So yeah, it's exciting times for us. And so we many years ago thought that we needed to have a footprint in the world market, and we've got that by Unison Steadfast.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you. Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Your next question comes from Naveen Patne with ENP. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, guys. Just a follow-up question from the previous question. You mentioned that it's a long way to go in your own backyard, sort of $120 million of EBITDA to go. I was interested in if you could provide some distinction between how much of that $120 million is already Steadfast equity owned to some extent versus just being network growth.
No, that's non-equity growth.
All non-equity. Yeah.
Non-equity, okay. Cool, okay. And is it fair to assume over the next couple of years that the lion's share of your M&A will be continuation of the trapped capital initiative, just given the size of the opportunities rather than some of the larger deals that we've been accustomed to seeing over the last few years?
Look, I think it's fair to say that that's true, okay, but that doesn't mean that we wouldn't be geared up to do a major acquisition if we had to do it.
Okay. All right. Great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Nadine. Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. There are no further questions at this time. I'll now hand back to Mr. Kaley for closing remarks.
Okay, thank you, Jack. Well, look, thanks everybody. It's gone a little bit over time with what we did, but I hope two things we've done. We've informed you about where we're at. We've given you an honest and truthful update at the status of the business. We've engaged with you on Trapp Capital, so you know exactly where we're going and what we're trying to achieve there. And on behalf of the team here, I can assure you we will continue to drive the success of this business as we have done since August 2013. So thank you for your time. I'll look out the windows in Sydney for those, and it looks like we should be building an ark because the amount of water that's falling. All I can say is that as an insurance professional, I look at that and go, claims, and claims makes extra premium, and so extra premium means revenue. And so thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.